Thanks for joining Wintrust Business Lunch and staying with WGN Radio throughout your day. I'm Jisoo Yi. Let's go ahead and get started. We're going to be talking about all the Macy's stores closing. Macy's had the second worst performing stock in the S&P last year. Shares fell 43%. They announced they'll close 28 namesake stores and one Bloomingdale's in the coming weeks, including shortening and cutting down on some headcount on the Bloomingdale's as well. Macy's currently operates 12 stores in Chicago area, and in 2017 there were 24 stores in the state of Illinois. Now there are only 16. Joining us to talk about the closings and is Brandon Rowe, a consumer marketing consultant. Hi, Brandon. Thanks for joining us. Oh, you know what? We're grabbing Brandon. He is the co-author of Why Fashion Brands Die and a specialist in online technology solutions as well for brand marketing. Hi, Brandon. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing today?
Great. Fantastic. We can hear you now. Okay. So what? What did you make of this retail apocalypse that happened in 2019? More than 9,300 closures. And of course, some big name brands that we all thought were safe. Forever 21, Charming Charlie Payless, AC Moore, Barney's.
Well, it is a very complicated picture, but it is something of a long-standing trend. We first saw this actually with the book industry in the late 90s. Amazon came on the scene. They found a way to deliver product at a cheaper price, more variety than a local bookstore could, and they put bookstores out of the business. Now, fast forward to 20 years later. For a long time, people didn't think the clothing industry, the fashion industry, would follow the way the book industry did, because you want to try on the clothes first. But consumers have come around, especially the younger consumers, to the idea of buying clothes online, and retail stores are not adapting, just like many bookstores did not adapt, and consequently, we have the retail apocalypse.
Now, is this all because department stores are struggling to adapt to the changes in the way consumers shop, and what do you think some of the solutions are?
Sure. So, yes, on the first point, the retailers are still looking at what we call the old fashion consumer. In my book, Why Fashion Brands Die, we have this concept called the new fashion consumer. And this new fashion consumer is fully online. They get their ideas online. They do their research and get feedback online. They make the purchase online. And a lot of brands are starting with that, are struggling with that to understand who that is. But there are definitely solutions. The first one is that brands need to get over the idea that nothing can be done. This was true in the days of the book. This is true now when it comes to the retailer struggling. The first step, and probably the most important step, is to really understand who their best and most profitable customer are. What do they love and what do they hate? What makes them happy? What makes them sad? Really understand their psychology. That might sound easy in principle, but I see this every day in the market that the retailers are focused on selling product and not focused on understanding their customer and why the customer buys. And so they lose to the lowest priced option, which tends to be online. The second, the brands need to understand the world they live in. What are the trends driving their lives now and tap into that? And third, they need to anticipate. The brands need to really anticipate how technology is going to affect their consumers coming forward, because that is the trend. The younger ones are very digital. They understand this, and that is where the game is going to be made or lost.
Brandon, do you see any specific consumer trends that businesses need to pay attention to in 2020?
Absolutely. One of the big ones right now is sustainability. Within my area, fashion, where I spend a lot of time, it's been a big theme for a while. But over the last year, it's really become a huge mainstream issue. There's lots of different campaigns. Greta Thunberg was the person of the year, obviously, on her environmental issues, her conversations. And it's something that's become a mainstream issue, and brands need to keep that aware and honor sustainability, make it a core of value. Second, they have to be aware that the consumer is going to continue to fragment. Consumers define themselves ever more narrowly. 50 years ago, if you knew somebody's age, income, and their gender, where they were located, you could pretty well define who they were as consumers. Now, consumers consider themselves very, very different. They narrow themselves. They put themselves in very narrow boxes, and brands have to go out to these people and interact with them on an almost individual basis. And the third trend is really personalization. Thanks to technology, thanks to things like artificial intelligence and other software, consumers, especially the younger consumers, they expect the brands that they buy from to really understand almost at an individual level. And this is hard for old-fashioned brands to get their heads around, but it is very important.
Brandon, thanks so much for joining us. Brandon Rowe is a consumer marketing consultant and author of Why Fashion Brands Die, and also a specialist in online technology solutions for brand marketing. We'll definitely have you back on sometime. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Joining us to talk about CES. CES stands for the Consumer Electronics Show. Of course, this is huge. The hub for advances in television, tech, mobile computing, and automotive that happens in Las Vegas. It started this past Tuesday. It's going to keep going until tomorrow. But folks visit, they check out all the new technology and all the wonderful things that you're going to be seeing on the market as a consumer. Of course, it's not open to consumers, but there are a lot of media folks that go and check everything out for you and get us excited about what's going to be rolling out. And joining us right now is editor-at-large for CNET, Ian Scher. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fantastic. So you've been there already since Tuesday. You've got one more day left. Well, you got the rest of today and tomorrow. You're going to give us a roundup of what's been super exciting.
Yeah, there's been a lot of really interesting technology. And look, every year there's this big hype around all of these new kind of technologies that we get to see. There's a lot of out there stuff. There's a lot of really beneficial stuff that we see. Okay, this could really help people. And then there's some stuff that's a little wacky. So, I'll start with the most interesting stuff that we saw. Probably my favorite that I've heard of is LG, the company that makes all sorts of home appliances, has a television that they made that rolls up like a poster board. And it rolls up into a little box. And the whole idea is that it can roll up when you're not using it. You know, a lot of us have our TVs in our living rooms, and they're just these big black boxes when you're not using them. And that's pretty ugly and annoying. Apple and Roku and a couple of others have really nifty screen savers that they've done that are really beautiful. Other companies have actually sold apps that will make it look like wallpaper, which is also pretty nifty. But this, I think, is probably the best option. Just roll it up and put it in a little box and walk it away if you want to. Now, it is a little expensive. It's $60,000. That's 60. But it's a start, and I bet within 5 or 10 years it'll be a lot cheaper than that.
Why am I cringing thinking about rolling up a $60,000 television? Is this going to be safe to do over and over again? And what about all the cords and plugins?
Yeah, so the way that it works with all those cords is that the base that it rolls into is where all those plug in. So you don't have to worry about all of that. And yes, you should be cringing when you think about rolling up a television. This is part of this new trend we're starting to see, where these flexible screens that we've been hearing about for ages are finally starting to hit the market. So you saw the Galaxy Fold phone last year that was $1,000, way too much money. That device uses the same rolling, foldable technology that exists out there. Now, it's not perfect, you know, especially when it comes to phones, you know, they have to have a plastic cover instead of glass because glass doesn't fold, last time I checked.
Ian,
those are things they have to get over, but that, you know, it is what it is.
For $60,000, I want it to be perfect, sir.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, this is part of being on the bleeding edge. And I agree with you. I would not spend $60,000 on this. So, you know, look, but there are probably at least five people who will. And eventually, like I said, and what I love about this show is that I have a bet that in the, you know, not too distant future, all of our TVs will roll up and fold up and all of that. It's just that this is the beginning stage where they really charge an arm and a leg for it.
Let's keep talking about TVs because people love TVs and they like to upgrade them. There's also a 292-inch television.
Yeah, so this is something that Samsung shows off. They've shown it off before. They've talked about now they have two different models of it. It's called the wall, and the reason is because it's basically the size of a wall, and they say that the quality is out of this world. Our TV reviewer, David Katzmeier, who is one of the best out there, he actually got to see it. He's really impressed by it. Now, this is once again one of those luxury items, and it's so luxury that Samsung doesn't even give us the price. That should be a sign to you right there. But this is part of the interesting thing, right, is that, you know, there's the idea of there are too many screens in our lives. Let's get them folding up and going away and easy to put away. And then there are other people who are like, no, not enough screen in my life. I want more. And so this is the other end of that, right, where you basically transform your entire living room wall into a television. I don't know which one's going to end up, but, you know, it's interesting to see these two ideas out there.
Good grief. How large of a living room do you need to sit back and be able to get the entire view? But let's talk about some of the more fun and kooky off-the-wall stuff that's happening there as well. We all love the movie WALL-E. And the WALL-E chair, you got to see it? Did you get to ride in it?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Segway, the people who make those little mobile things that a lot of people who are doing various groups around town and stuff and getting to see tours, you often see them, or mall cops, right? They're really popular with them. Well, they have a new device that they call it looks like an egg chair, right? It's very similar from WALL-E. And the whole idea is that this thing, which they call the S-Pod, will allow you to sit down, and it's on two wheels, and it walks you around. It just drives everywhere. It's very similar to the way that the self-balancing a scooter works, where you just kind of lean and it goes. We have video on CNET, of course, of people riding around in it with a helmet, because there were a couple of accidents where people bumped into stuff. But, you know, they say people want to be comfortable and they want to move around. And this thing can go up to, I think, 12 or 14 miles an hour. Actually, it goes to 24 miles per hour, my bad. So, you know, eventually, one day, maybe we're all going to be going down the streets in these things.
And then we won't be using our legs, just like the cartoon characters in WALL-E.
That's right, yeah. We'll all be at 1,000 pounds. And, you know.
Something else that's super fun is the Charmin has created a toilet paper helper. And of course, we've all been in that situation where you've been in the bathroom and then you think, oh my goodness, where's the toilet paper? I need more of it.
Yes, and now it's called the Poop Time Robot. I did not come up with that name. They did. Will bring you an emergency toilet roll. And this is actually mostly the thought they have is that this would be really useful in a public restroom where that issue comes up more often than at home. but, you know, it's an interesting idea. It shows that the tech industry is trying to really hit more on our life issues rather than just sell us another phone, which I appreciate. I don't think Charmin's actually going to sell this robot in the end. I think it's just an idea. But it goes to show that companies you never would have thought of getting into tech, they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And of course, this is really important for a lot of drivers. We've all experienced this where the sun is just hitting you at the exact spot where you can't see the road. And there is a sun visor that's going to create the right amount of shade that you need.
Yeah, it's really nifty. So what it is it's a see-through lens that they can put up in your car, and then there's a camera that watches your eyes. And what they do is that they know when the sun's hitting you at exactly the specific spot, and it basically makes that part of the visor go gray. And it's really fascinating. There's a photo we have on CNET to help you understand what it looks like, but the idea they have is they said, look, there's actually a lot of accidents that happen when people are using a normal fabric sunscreen and they can't see the full vision of the windows. And so by removing that problem, they could really help us. Not to mention, the sunscreens don't always work. My wife and I were driving down the road one day, and her sunscreen did not fully cover her face at the right angle to stop the sun. This, in theory, could solve a lot of those problems because it's using cameras and a whole screen to basically learn where the sun's hitting you and then direct the sun to turn gray at that point.
Love it. A little bit of something for everyone. Ian, where can people find all your reviews on what's been happening over at CES?
Of course, it's all on CNET.com. We've got still, there's another day of the show on, so we've got video going on, and we've got, obviously, our Twitter and Instagram are going crazy. We're about to name some of our most interesting stuff that we saw at the show, so I put in, of course, my vote for the poop robot, but we'll see which one wins.
All right. And... Well, thank you so much, Ian Scher, editor-at-large for CNET. Really appreciate you being with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking to a CEO of a Penny Pritzker-backed group with a goal of making Chicago a top-tier city for tech companies. The group's name is P33, a nonprofit that has recently taken up shop in Fulton Market neighborhood. So that is coming up. Imagine this, Chicago, a top-tier city for tech companies to rival Silicon Valley and Research Triangle Park and North Carolina. Joining me now is a CEO of P33. It's a nonprofit group backed by Penny Pritzker with just that goal in mind. Brad Henderson, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
So I know that we talked a little bit about your organization earlier this week. We didn't quite get it right. So I want you to clarify and tell us exactly what P33 is about.
Sure. P33 is a coalition of civic leaders, business leaders, and academic leaders across the Chicagoland region who've come together to develop an integrated plan to return Chicago by the year 2033. To its rightful place as one of the leading hubs across the country as a tech and innovation leader, and to do so in a way that is inclusive of all of our people and institutions.
Before you answer how you plan to do this, I'd also like to know why you think we haven't gotten there already.
Yeah, Chicago is blessed with so many great things. I mean, it's to dwell on the negatives would be a fault. just to look at the vibrancy, the new ideas, the culture, the strength of our universities, innovative new businesses like Grubhub and Tempest Labs. I mean, we've got a lot going for us. But the reality is in the data is over the past 20 years, we have lost share of the innovation economy. And the question is why? And for us, the big missing piece is in Chicago, oftentimes, we're very siloed in the way that we solve problems. And so if we're blessed to have two national labs like Fermi and Argonne National Lab out in the suburbs, in downtown, we've got businesses in a whole range of industries that benefit from that science. Historically, when you look at Chicago relative to Boston or San Francisco, we just haven't been as good at connecting those dots, bringing the right people into the room, and actually benefiting from the diversity of those capabilities and perspectives. And so what P33 really is focusing on is making sure that we tap into and take advantage of that diversity, because I think because we're more siloed than other cities, we leave some of the opportunities on the table.
So how will it work exactly? And to call you guys a booster or an incubator isn't quite correct or on the nose.
No, we have some great incubators in Chicago like 1871 and MHUB, and they're part of our coalition and play a really critical role. What P33 has done is all of our work is steeped very deep in research. So we spent about 18 months with leaders across Chicago, accumulated about 700 megabytes of, think of it almost the executive health check for Chicago innovation. And so what we've identified are four or five big opportunities that we think will make the difference. And then what we're doing is we're designing programming across universities, across companies, startups, investors, et cetera, to go tackle those problems together. To give you an example, in the next 5 to 10 years, this notion of quantum computing, which is probably one of the most one of the biggest innovations in the computer science realm in decades, it will become a reality. We're blessed in Chicago to have some of the best research in this field that will change everything from how medicines work to how the internet works. But there's this risk if we don't work with companies, if we don't pull in startups to solve that problem, if we aren't working closely with the federal and the local government, that we'll have great research, but we won't have great businesses in quantum computing. And so one of the things we're working on is actually building a coalition in Chicago across all those institutions in something like quantum to make sure that we win and we win for all of our citizens. We've got five or six areas like that where we're designing integrated programming to go solve our biggest challenges and opportunities.
So, Brad, you're going to have to elaborate a little bit on quantum computing. All I know about it is that it's exponentially in terms of processing and being able to take in more data, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's basically, that's a very good way of summarizing it. It's taking something that might take one of our best supercomputers now, 1,000 years to solve a problem. And if it really achieves its potential, that computing power could be condensed to minutes of problem solving. And the way it does that is it actually, instead of using ones and zeros on silicon like computers have now for a long time, it uses little quantum particles to run those simulations. It's getting into quantum physics and quantum chemistry. And so it just infinitely expands what can be done. And that's really exciting if you're a company like AbbVie, a company in Chicago that makes drugs to help people. They spend so much time trying to guess and simulate and test what might make neurological disorders easier to manage. If they had this kind of computing power, they could solve the problems in front of them more effectively and more efficiently. And that's very exciting.
You just talked about fairness and trying to make this equitable as well and available for all people of the Chicago area. How do you guys plan to do that?
Yeah, there are two pieces for us. The first is Chicago is blessed. We have lots of jobs and some really stellar institutions, whether it's CPS, city colleges, our universities to prepare students. But the reality is we have one of the most confusing and fragmented workforce infrastructures in the country. And so if your parents are well off and you're connected, navigating this complicated system and this dynamic economy is manageable. But if you're from a struggling neighborhood, you don't have a parent who went to college, you don't have access to how to navigate not-for-profits, career coaching programs, boot camps, two-year degrees, four-year degrees, it's a very daunting city to build a career. And so what we're really trying to do is make it for the folks who often get left out in this work to make it so that the path into successful digital careers is far more manageable. And we're designing programming across employers and not-for-profits and colleges to make that easier and more accessible. Similarly, a lot of the investment that goes into tech companies ends up in three or four zip codes. Our research identified that very little of that investment goes to specific Chicago neighborhoods that are often overlooked. And so we're working with a range of partners to make sure more capital goes into more neighborhoods to help those neighborhoods build tech businesses, not just the West Loop, the Loop, River North, et cetera.
So, Brad, I know that how long have you been with P33? You were just recently recruited, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I spent 20 years with the Boston Consulting Group and was a civic leader on the side in Chicago, but fully joined P33 in the late summer, and we've been working to build our team since.
Well, welcome to Chicago. I hope you're prepared. Well, you're prepared for the winter. You're from Boston, so you'll be fine.
Yeah,
what are you looking forward to the most about this new endeavor?
I see.
Yeah, to me, the way I look at it is Chicago sits at this interesting moment where we could fall behind and end up being a Rust Belt city, or truly flourish as the hub for innovation in the Midwest. And I think that's for the question for my kids who are 8 and 6 and other people of that generation. How do leaders in my generation make sure we come together so that 20 years from now, as people come out of college, they are walking into a city that is competitive, where there's real access, and you could really build a life and a career in a digital world. That's what motivates me. I think this is a critical moment. All of Chicago has to work together to make that happen. And I'm very eager to be part of a coalition to do that.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. This is the CEO of P33, Brad Henderson. And we truly are looking forward to seeing how all of this unfolds and looking forward to the day that we rival Silicon Valley as well. So thank you so much for doing this for Chicago and everybody that lives in the Chicago area. Yay. Thank you, Brad.
Yeah, thanks. The pleasure is mine. Have a great day.
You as well. Amy Guth, host of Crane's Daily Gist in studio. A lot happening today.
Yeah, lots of interesting stories floating around. One really interesting story, this is a fairly new story, and there is a life sciences hub that has just been announced, planned for Fulton Market. This is coming from a Dallas-based developer, Trammell Crow, which has suddenly started showing up in real estate conversations here in Chicago. So they're on the map, they're doing stuff. Also right in that area. But what they're doing is they've announced that they have plans for a 400,000 square foot lab and office building in Fulton Market. What's interesting about this is that it's a bet that a lot of developers don't want to make because it's so expensive. It's not like, hey, I'll put up this giant office building and whatever tenants come in, they can paint the walls whatever color. You have to put in very special ventilation. You have to have very special security because you're dealing with high stakes intellectual property. You know, you're talking about stuff like that. There's, you know, you have to plan for the worse, like a chemical reaction and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff involved. And then what may be perfect for one tenant might be completely wrong for another because you have to have such specialized lab space. However, Chicago does have a shortage of that. And so this is what Trammell Crow is betting on, that this big facility kind of will be like a hub for pharmaceutical and biotech companies in Chicago and start to kind of compete with other companies or other cities rather, because what happens is we have like a pharma or biotech startup or something in that space, and then we lose them to San Francisco or Boston because they have such developed facilities for that kind of thing. So much lab space, things like that. So this won't solve it. You know, this is a big economic priority for both the city and the state, and it won't solve it, but it's certainly a huge step. I mean, 400,000 square feet, you can accomplish a lot of smart people can accomplish a lot of smart things, right? In that space. So this is exciting. And it's again, every day there's more news from Fulton Market. And if you think about, I think about this all the time. Every time I'm down there, I'm like, you know, this, when Girl and the Goat first went in, and when Publican first went in.
Or when Oprah Studios.
When Oprah's, it was a very different place. Very, very different place. So, you know, to look at it now and to look at the money pouring into that space and what's happening there, it's really telling a very different story than a lot of other parts of the city.
It's fascinating because every week I feel as though I'm asking you, how much more can go into the neighborhood? And you keep telling me more can.
There's two things we do every week, and it's how much worse can it get for Boeing and what more can happen in Fulton Market? And like, this week has not disappointed, like news in both of those things. So that's a really big story that just kind of bubbled up in the last couple of hours. They've been quietly planning this for about a year, working on the brand of what this will be. And this big market or this big facility. And then, you know, now they got the building, now they got everything in order, and they're going to be talking about that a lot. So stay tuned. We'll see more of, like, I mean, I'm interested to know who are going to be the tenants, who's going to come in there, who might we recruit, especially in Fulton Market where you have a lot of other, you know, company money coming in.
Well, I'm fascinated by this because we just talked with CEO of P33
that we talked about yesterday.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So it's, and they're also in Fulton Market.
That's right.
And so that's fascinating. And it's in a building also by, I believe, by Trammell Crow. So.
That's exactly right. Why we were talking about that yesterday.
I know. Yeah. See, there we go.
So,
okay. So you've got some news on Walgreens suing doctors.
Well, so this is, there's a big case that's been happening. It is the National Prescription Opiate Litigation. It's in federal court in Ohio. And so drugstores have filed complaints against physicians for allegedly fueling the epidemic in two different counties in Ohio. So, you know, when we were thinking about the line of responsibility to fuel an opioid crisis, there's people trying to say, well, the pharmacy companies have, or not the pharmacy, the pharmacist chains, rather, have a role in this. And they're saying, hey, look, pharmacists are not doctors. They did not go to medical school. They're not prescribing it. Don't put this on them. So they're kind of trying to, this is going to be interesting, I think, very precedent setting for exactly where this lands, because of course doctors want to say, hey, it's pharmaceutical companies, and pharmaceutical companies are going, yo, it's not us, it's on you guys. You know, so there's a lot of kind of like passing the buck here. And I think this is going to be a really interesting story to watch. And so Walgreens, CVS, and Walmart have said in their complaints that if these two counties do find them liable, the doctors who prescribe the medications should ultimately be responsible to cover whatever amount is determined at trial. So that's an interesting story, I think, to watch. But another one, a little bringing it back in town, a little closer to home. So McDonald's, locally based company there, we've talked about them a little bit in the new year because they've just had this big leadership change. They made a lot of tech investment. You probably saw like those kiosks.
Yes.
Personally, I like to talk to a person when I walk into a place to order food. But
you want that friendly smile.
Yeah. And, you know, if you go through the whole thing and then the kiosk just goes, we can't process your order. Go to the counter. You're like, I would have done that. But anyway, so there a lot of fast food companies are like Taco Bell has them and McDonald's has these ordering kiosks.
I noticed that at Wow Bao, they don't even have a person.
That's right.
Even in the
totally. There's not even a person there. You're like,
you
I want to talk.
Ask anyone for help
I
at the kiosk.
I have questions about my Bao for crying out loud. That's right. So McDonald's has made a lot of tech investments from personalization, delivery, customer loyalty, ordering, all kind of stuff. And so what they've done now, because there's a lot of pressure from Wall Street and from franchisees saying, okay, we've done all this stuff. Show us the money. Show the return here. So McDonald's has created a team that is a digital customer engagement team. Interesting. I mean, to me, that was interesting. I first saw that and I was like, well, wait, they don't have that already? It seems like they would have had that. This is a team really looking at just the metrics of this, saying like, finding out, do customers like having a digital relationship with McDonald's? What are the pain points? Where does it get jammed up? What's frustrating? And I think because they want to maximize those returns and deliver for Wall Street and franchisees.
Amy, I think they need to interview you about the pain points of ordering from a kiosk. I think you will be able to enlighten them very much as they develop this technology.
I mean, I should probably, I'm not the biggest fast food person, but, you know, sure. If that's what it takes, in the name of journalism, if I need to go eat a bunch of Big Macs, I'll do it.
I'm expecting that to be on your very next.
I'll go undercover.
Absolutely.
I'll do a thing.
Where can people listen to the podcast?
Well, as ever, they can find it on Stitcher, on Spotify, and on iTunes. You can subscribe to Crane's newsletters. There's a great afternoon newsletter that has all the top headlines and always has a link to the podcast. Or you can find it on WGN Plus. It's easy to find. It's everywhere. Or follow me on Twitter because I always tweet it out.
And what's your Twitter handle?
I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, not G-O-O-S-E, like some people that send me mail here think.
G-U-T-H.
It rhymes. It Guth like truth. It's easy, folks.
There you go. You are always speaking the truth.
I'm
Thanks,
trying.
As always, Crane's Daily Gist host, Amy Guth. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.